position number 211128, wheel 3.
Bob Doe, reel 3.
Right, having sent down to Delhi, a number of interesting things happened while I was there. I cannot remember the time scale of it accurately, but I'll say them anyway. First of all, Orchid Neck was commander-in-chief at the time, army commander-in-chief, and we had an RAF commander-in-chief. And the feeling between the army and the air force became rather bad at one stage, because the RAF commander-in-chief had been found in Brighton with the army commander-in-chief's wife, which really didn't go down very well. Anyway, the army commander-in-chief was moved shortly after that, and the man called Mountbatten came out as commander-in-chief, and I was attached to his secretariat. And I had quite an interesting time. First of all, the war finished out there, and I was given the job of running an air display for the whole of India and coordinating the flying part of an Indian tattoo. And this was great fun. I was given a staff and a couple of cars and this sort of thing. And this was great fun. I enjoyed doing that. The final thing was we held the air display at Willingdon Airport, which was Delhi Airport. And I had it made available to me. Everything was left in India, really, to do with what I liked. And I'd organised all the flying, and we had a big fort built. And we planned to rocket this fort and bomb it and drop paratroops on it as being the finale of the air show. And we thought we'd do a curtain of a smoke screen. Now, having done it on one side of the runway, providing the wind's down the runway and away from spectators, we had no problem. So I decided that we'd carry on with it. If at the last minute the wind changed, I would be able to cancel it anyway, because I was in control of the whole operation from the tower. And everyone was there. The Viceroy was Wavell, and Viceroyine, Lady Wavell. And it really was a very good show. It lasted all 2.5 hours. And then the finale came with this fort being attacked, rocketed, bombed, and paratroops dropped on it. And then the smoke screen, which was the curtain. They started laying the smoke and the wind changed. The smoke blew straight across the spectators. Well, I was presented to Viceroy and Viceroyine after this do. The Viceroyine had arrived in a white suit. I was introduced to her. She was wearing a dove grey suit, and she had streaks down her face. I often wonder why I didn't get an OBU for that. Anyway, it was all fun, these things happened. Also, while I was there, a tiny bit of history that went wrong. We had a signal from the Sultan of Muscat to Mountbatten saying, "As you know, my cousin, the Imam of Oman, stole half my country from me in 1923. He is at the moment is sick in a certain fort." If you hear the reference to this fort, which is quite close to Muscat, "if you could lend me some paratroops and take this fort, I will give the oil rights in Muscat and Oman to Great Britain for perpetuity." And we had a battalion of paratroops in the country. We had a Halifax paratroop dropping squadron in the country. We did a quick appreciation, realised that we could do this thing. We could send a destroyer out there to pick up the paratroops. We could have done the thing over a weekend. They could have back in India on the Monday. No one would know anything about it. So we had to get approval from the UK for this sort of thing, obviously. So we sent a signal back, Mountbatten recommended it. We just had an election in this country. Churchill wasn't Prime Minister anymore, and his successor would not approve it. very sad. Anyway, I was then sent to Kabul, Afghanistan. The Afghani Air Force was made up of two squads of Hawker Hinds, which were biplanes, which we kept going during the war by making bits for the airplanes by the Halton apprentices. That part of their training was making bits for these airplanes. And they were just sent up by road into Afghanistan once a month. Anyway, I was sent up there with the Rolls-Royce rep and the Hawker rep to try and get them to buy Spitfires, which they could have at £1,000 each. Because we had a glut of aircraft left over in India, didn't we? So I went off up there and went up by road in a special bus that had been built for the embassy. We went up once a week, I think it was. The return journey was a week, there and back. And we spent the night in Jalalabad, halfway there, and then over the Lantaban Pass into Kabul, which is quite an experience because they have a track 10,000 feet up with the sheer drop one side. The thing's only about 9 foot wide, the track, and a vertical rock face the other side. Or the horse was just made of stones. You were driving stones, it wasn't a secure surface. Anyway, this bus made it. And I was petrified. I think I lost 5 years of my life in that trip up there. But I had to admire the work because this road had been cut out from the rock by people the last century. And there were sort of drill holes every 6 inches where they had to blast the rock away. And then eventually we got to Kabul where an RAF officer had been attached to the Afghanis for the whole war. He'd had a very cushy war, really. Anyway, I went and stayed with him because I was not allowed into the embassy, obviously, because I was active warfare, as it were. And I tried to get the Afghanis interested. But what I discovered when I got there was that all of the equipment for the entire Afghan Air Force was kept in one building in the capital. And they had seven equipment officers, each of them having a key. All seven keys had to be there to open this thing to get anything to issue it. If you were late for work, you were sent to jail for a month with your key. I couldn't visualize Spitfires under those conditions, really. However, it was a very nice month I spent there, and the one thing really stuck in my mind from then, when the British got out of Afghanistan about 1942, I suppose, they gave the king, who was commander-in-chief of the armed forces, they gave him a Rolls-Royce, which had been specially built for him. It was a 2+2. And it was all silver and with huge grating on the front, nothing but the king's signature on the front of it. Well, Afghanistan's a country the size of France, and there was only about half a mile of tarmac in the whole of the country, and the king enjoyed driving this beast. And he'd hit a rock at high speed and sheared off. There was 15 stainless steel bolts holding front suspension on, and he'd sheared 7 of them. So you had full lock one way, and only partial lock the other way. And the thing boiled easily. So we asked if we could see the car a couple of days before we came back, because we asked if we'd bring it back to the nearest Rolls-Royce agent. And the driver who lived with this thing came down. Apparently, we gave this thing to the king, keeping it sweet, obviously, when we got out. And they, at that time, had no clue how to look after this monster. So he'd sent his Farsi driver down to the only place where they had an engineer left in the whole of Kabul, which was the German embassy. And he said, how do I look after this monster? And this German engineer said, well, it's wonderful. But whatever you do, you never put oil in it. From the time they got it, to the time we got there in 1946, they'd never put the oil in it. And it was boiling, as you can imagine. Anyway, we got it and we dipped the sump, and there was only just a trace of oil at the bottom of the dipstick. So we filled it up with oil, we tightened up everything we could find, which was an awful lot of loose bits on it. And we tightened down the tappets, and we didn't know what they ought to be, but we knew what a Spitfire was, so we tightened it down to what a Spitfire tappets were, which was four on the exhaust and not all, six on the, oh, for the one way round the other, anyway. We gave it a run, and it seemed to run much better, but it still boiled. So he realised we'd had to come over these passes, 10,000 foot passes at night, to keep it as cool as possible. So we set off to come back with Farsi driver sitting in the back. And every one of the hairpin bends, of which there are about 20 on that route, was the way which we only had 10 degree lock. There's one looking behind, one in front and one behind, saying, "It's another 6 inches, stop!" But the shear dropped one side, and it was quite hairy. Anyway, we eventually got through, and it was a beautiful drive. I loved driving this car, I really enjoyed it. And we arrived on Sunday in Delhi, and we found the house of the owner of the biggest car firm, which is the Rolls-Royce agents in Delhi. And we rather that he had a little shock when we turned up, very scruffy looking out, and he said, "Well, you better hang on to it, we'll bring it into the garage on Monday morning." So we went to the races in this beautiful car. When we got there, of course, everything was chock-a-block full, but everything was pushed back out of the way for the royal car to come in, because remember, it held the Royal Crest of Arms on the front. And we, and scruffy out, scholar, and dirty uniforms. Anyway, we had a very enjoyable time. I was then sent home. I got home in end of 1946. And I was posted to the School of Combined Operations, which was in North Devon, where we were teaching people to do things we knew they'd never do again. But I had a very enjoyable time there because I played cricket for Devon while I was down there. So I had a very happy time playing cricket.
What were these things that they would never do again?
Combined operations. Invasions, like Overlord, that sort of thing. We taught the techniques for it. But we realised that the way wars change, it can never happen again. Anyway, I was there, and then I then posted from there to Headquarters Reserve Command, where a man called Chris Foxley Norris, who's the head of the Battle of Britain Association, he and I ran the Auxiliary Air Force for Reserve Command. And we had a rather amusing story out of there. There's a man called Bob Wilson and I were the two opening bowlers for the Air Force at that time. We were both very quick. And the local village of White Walton, very friendly lot, and we were in the pub one night, and the local schoolmaster, who was captain of the village cricket, came up and said, "Will you do us a favour, turn up for us next Sunday? We've got our annual blood match against Bracknell, I think it was. And we've got to beat them. They've beaten us for the last 6 years or something." So we said, okay. We turned up. And we were doing rather well. We got to about 7 day wickets down for about 40 runs. And the last chap had been caught, I think. And I didn't see their new batsman coming in. So I had to open a new over to this new batsman. And he proceeded to hit me for 5 sixes in a row of a square leg, which hadn't happened to me before, ever. But I'd got my square leg packed by then, and I had him caught on the square leg boundary on the off the sixth ball, and he started limping out. So I turned to the umpire, who was at my end, and I said, "Well, look, I hadn't hit him, what's wrong with him?" He said, "He's only got one leg." Anyway, I was then posted back out to Egypt. I was posted to as Seish master at Amman, which was in Jordan. And my wife and I and our one child we had then, Helen, sailed up there, and as we approached Portside, a launch came up from Portside, and it was Tanwai came up saying, "Is Bob Dole on board?" I looked at him and said, "Yeah, I'm here." He said, "You think you're going to Amman? No way can you play cricket for us at Amman, so you're going to going here to Egypt." Because I used to run the cricket as well in Egypt at the time when I was there. And I was made Air Plans headquarters, Egypt. And just before then, we'd had an awful lot of trouble with the Israelis. They had shot down half a squadron of ours. It was half a 2-8 squadron. And a very bad feeling between the Israelis and the British at the time. And as a result, there was a fighter wing, a jet fighter wing stationed in Egypt, which I reckon was the most inefficient fighter wing I had ever seen. And I kept trying to talk about this to people that ought to know. The only snag was that the AOC was an equipment officer, and he was the wrong person to try and direct fighter wing. Well, eventually someone must have heard the right word, and he was posted, and a man who was legend in the Air Force time, good David actually, was sent out as AOC. Well, I had commanded a squadron under him before, and the first day that he arrived there, I was sent for, and he said, "Good morning, Bob. Would you like to take over 32 squadron?" I said, "Thank you, sir. When can I get there?" He said, "How soon can you do it?" I said, 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. He said, "Okay, it's all yours." Well, the only snag was, 32 squadron had Vampire jets, and I had never flown a jet. And I looked bloody stupid turning up the squadron having never flown a jet, wouldn't I? So I got in the car and tore down the canal zone to the maintenance unit which repaired Vampires and looked after them. And I got hold of the test pilot in the bar at lunchtime, bought him a lot of beer, and asked him how to fly a Vampire. And I borrowed one for him after lunch and flew it, so I could drive the next morning having flown a Vampire. Now, there was one trick with Vampires in those days, was starting them. If you didn't get it exactly right, it was rather like a car being overdoped. You know, it would never fire, whatever happened, if you got too much dope in the thing. And so I had a briefing. I've always had a thing with, when I took over anything, I'd always get the squadron there as one mass and control the mass operation and do a stream landing at the end of it, which I reckon was the only way to get control of the squadron. And so I briefed them all for this, and I got hold of the engineer officer and said, "Look, Chief, I'll be a bit late getting out." And the temperature outside was, what, 90 or something like that. And I said, "Be kind enough to start my aircraft up for me so I don't keep the jets sitting around the sun." And they didn't know for 6 months I hadn't flown one. I got away with it. I was very proud of it. And that was the time when the Egyptians were getting anti-British, and we couldn't go off the base without an armed escort. Otherwise, you could get your throat cut or shot or something. And so we were really cut off there. And the part of our camp included a bit of the Great Bitter Lake. So I organised that squadron, and I got the naffy to provide us with the lobe steaks, and we used to have barbecues on this sunny bit of beach, all the troops and officers all got together. And we used to have a wonderful time down there, and kept the chaps together, and they used to love it. And a nice little bit of history came back from that some time back. I've got a lot of Brits coming down here and sort of talk to me and get signatures on things. And one of the police sergeants up in Derbyshire came down and said he'd got a painting, would I be kind enough to sign it for him? It's not for him. It's for a mate of his down the road. He's a police sergeant, army sergeant, who had been at this place, Devoswar, where I had the squadron. And he said he's so impressed, by the way, that my squadron and I got on, that he got a picture of me. And he wanted to be kind of, I'd sign it. And I was very proud of that. Anyway, while I was there, one night, I was in bed about 11 o'clock, and down there you operated from about 6 in the morning until 1 o'clock when you packed up and went to sleep. That's the way things worked out there. And about 11 o'clock one night, I had a phone call, and would I go down to the AOC, which is down the other end of the canal zone. So I turned out a guard to give me an armed escort down there, and I tore down there to find that they'd had an intelligence briefing from Sudan, which was a condominium at that time, and they reckoned that the Egyptians were going to try and take over. As usual, the Egyptians had best part of a division of troops down there, and we had a company of 120 men. It's a normal British way of dealing with things. And he said that they had intelligence that the Egyptians were going to have a go at taking over Sudan. Would I get my squadron down there first thing the following morning and beat the place up and not damage or anything, but show them we were there? And I suggested it once, sir. And I went back. I got back about 12:30. I got the engineer off there out of bed, and he told me exactly what I'd been told, what I had to do. And I knew that we'd had 6 airplane service when we packed up the following day. Well, no CO could make it off of 6 aircraft. I'd be so ashamed I couldn't do it. And I told him, I'd turn the pilots up, give him a hand, and I got what I expected. There'll be a damn nuisance, so they'll get in my way, let them sleep. I'll pick you up at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. So I trust my men. I went to bed. He picked me up at 9 o'clock next morning, fresh uniform, freshly shaved in my Jeep, and took me down the flights. We had 16 airplanes set ready to go. Now, that was not possible, because 3 of them were waiting parts from maintenance units some distance away, and 2 were waiting parts from the United Kingdom. But what they'd done, they'd taken bits of other people's airplanes all over the place, and I had 16 aircraft ready to take off, all armed up and ready to go. Now, that wasn't possible, but this is why I love the British Airmen. I think they're incomparable. They are wonderful people. You tell them what's necessary, and they'll do it. But most important of all, tell them why it's necessary. They don't like to be left in the dark. They like to know. And they're wonderful. Anyway, I had a very happy time with them, and eventually I came home after that. And nearly a year after I left the squadron, I had the ring at the front doorbell. I went down there. One of the pilots of the squadron was standing there, his hands behind his back. He had a silver salver, which I've got on the table there. This is from the officers, NCOs and airmen of 32 Squadron. And I'm really proud of that. That's quite illegal too. You're not allowed to accept anything from your squadron. But I reckon this after I'd left them, it was all safe. There's no favours to be involved. I was really, really proud of that. Anyway, the war's finished by then. This was 1954 then. And I came home and was sent to my squadron in the Central Gunnery School. I keep getting involved with gunnery all the way along. And at the gunnery school, we used to have a team which went around the world. The idea was that we could show people how to use weapons on any new weapons and check up on their skills and try and improve them. And I was leading the team, we went down the Far East. And we took part in the, this is when the Malayan uprisings were on. And we took part in the region rocketing against the jungle targets. And then we were asked if we'd look at the French in Saigon, because they're having trouble rocketing the duck buffaloes. And we said, okay. And we were sent up there, and we told we'd go up in Sunderland. We land on the river outside Saigon. And so I would make a habit of going anywhere new like that. I was trying to find all I can about it. So I got hold of the captain of the Sunderland the night before and said, what gives, anything special? He said, well, go to Naffy and get your ration of whiskey for the month, which is one bottle of man per month. And I was 12 to 6, if I remember, old mummy. And anyway, we got a bottle of whiskey. He said, well, maybe don't open it. And we flew up to Saigon, where we landed on the river below the town. And that night we went into Saigon, which was known as the Paris of the East in those days. We went to one of their big nightclubs, and the captain of the Sunderland said, now, you put the bottle of whiskey on the table, and you have a choice. You can either have a free evening, now take your bottle of whiskey away. You can either have a free evening, or you can have 8 bottles of French champagne. So we had a free evening, didn't we? The crew of the Sunderland has 6 bottles of French champagne, or at least 8 bottles of French champagne, which they took back to Singapore and swapped for 6 bottles of whiskey, which they brought back to a very good racket there on. And anyway, we had a lovely free evening. And then we took off there the next morning to fly to Hong Kong. Well, in those days, you didn't have weather forecasting in those areas, and the China Sea was one of those places. Half an hour after we took off, we flew into the Intertropical Front, which stayed with us until we broke the cloud at Hong Kong. And the Sunderland, you know what Sunderland looks like. Well, the front bit like a greenhouse, lets in more water than it keeps out. And the flight deck was about 6 inches deep on water, of water all the way. And just after we'd taken off, the second pilot went sick with food poisoning. Well, we were in cloud on instruments at 500 feet. So we realised the captain would have no possibility of flying for 15 hours on instruments without any break. So we took in turns to fly this thing, having never flown such a monster in my life before. But as a result, I have a Sunderland in my flying room. And we took it in turns to fly this thing all the way to Hong Kong, where we landed, had a very happy time, and came back. And we got back to Singapore on Christmas Eve, and we flew back to England the same day, taking off Christmas Eve, in a York. And that was the noisiest airplane I've ever traveled in my life. We landed at Dum Dum on the way back, and then, we landed in Rangoon first of all, then Dum Dum, which was Calcutta. We spent the night at Calcutta in the Great Eastern Hotel. It was terrible. We had to get up at 1 o'clock to go down to take off, and the British test team were playing in Calcutta that weekend, the first test team out there after the war. And such a party was going on there that had to be seen to be believed. There was us, dead sober, and out to the airfield. And we got to the airfield to find the catering staff had gone on strike. So we had to fly all the way across India to Karachi, which is quite a few hours, without any food or drink whatsoever. And that was not very popular. Anyway, the curry we had when we got to Karachi was the most wonderful thing I'd eaten in years. And we then came home. We landed at Bahrain, where the eggs we had for breakfast at Bahrain, the whites were green, the yolks were slightly purple. But anyway, we got home. And then I did a number of different jobs. And I was then posted to the Chief of Staff Secretariat. Now, you've heard of the Cabinet Secretariat.
Yes.
Well, the Chief of Staff had a very similar setup. The chairman of the Chief of Staff at that time was a man called Mountbatten again. Now, when, in those days, this is when Britain had forces all over the world of considerable size, when we were the power in the Middle East still. We were a major power in the Middle East. Americans weren't very interested by then,